afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in the world. My name is Andrew Johnson, and I have with me Dr. Judy Wood. And just for this show, we are filling in for Deanna Spingola, who is otherwise engaged at this present time. And so you have us for the 3 hours, the next 3 hours, with all the breaks, of course. And I apologise if this show appears to be a little bit haphazard. I've wanted to spend more time doing some preparation, but I think nevertheless we are going to have some interesting topics to discuss, and hopefully some thought-provoking information for you to consider and digest, and hopefully go off and study after the programme. And you can visit my website, which is checktheevidence.com, and you can visit Dr. Judy Wood's website, which is drjudywood.com, which can be spelt either with the DR at the beginning or the word doctor, D-O-C-T-O-R. You can spell it that way as well. And if anybody wants to contact me during the program, then please either use my website. I think we will probably try and take some calls maybe in the third hour. We'll see how we go on. And if you do call in, please make it relevant to what we've been talking about. We don't really want to go too far off into other things. As you're probably aware, many listeners to the show will be aware, actually thanks to Deanna primarily, Dr. Judy Wood has written a book called Where Did the Towers Go, which still, 5 years after it was first became available, is the only forensic investigation into the events of 9/11, or some of the events anyway, which is actually happened at the World Trade Center. And some of the evidence in this book was submitted in a court case in 2007 and the years following that. And people need to be aware of this information if they are to make sense of a lot of what is going on. And in fact, one of the things I want to talk about is the ongoing cover-up of 9/11, which even just today, for example, I've been trying to actually illustrate is still happening right before us on social media and places like this. And so people need to be aware of this and how this is working, and we're going to try and discuss some of that. And as Dr. Wood has pointed out, the book, none of it's been refuted. There's been many efforts to actually refute it, but none have actually come, you know, they can't refute it because it's a set of evidence which shows what happened. So again, we'll probably talk about some of that. And once again, my website is checktheevidence.com. Dr. Judy Wood's websites are drjudywood.com and wheredidthetowersgo.com. I don't know if Dr. Wood wanted to say anything at this point. We're probably going to have a break any minute now because we have an early break. Dr. Wood, can you hear me?
Oh, yes, I can. Hello.
Yes, I just wondered if you wanted to say hello before, because I think we'll have a break after about 4 minutes or something, so I think we've probably got another minute. And, I mean, you'd brought up a couple of topics that we're probably going to discuss, fairly early on, because one of the things I want to go into probably after the first break is to talk about something called geoengineering. And it is often a word that is not used. Okay. Well, I'm getting a message here that we're not going to break until I think 1928. Okay, well, that will give me some time then. What I'll do is I'll ride with when the music comes in, and I'll see how I go on. Basically, I wanted to talk about geoengineering initially. What does this word mean? Well, essentially, it means engineering the environment we live in. And essentially, this the context in which this is meant is in engineering the weather. And this is a word which I would argue has entered the public's vocabulary. It's kind of been drip-fed into the public's vocabulary, I think, over about the last 6 years or so, maybe slightly longer. And I have certainly been to two what might be called public consultation meetings in Great Britain, run by the Royal Society, which is the oldest scientific society in the world. I think some of the original members included Sir Isaac Newton and Robert Hooke, the famous natural philosophers from the 1600s. And these, I think now, the public consultations were actually, to me, fairly meaningless, because they were part of the process of essentially brainwashing the public into this idea that carbon dioxide has had an effect on the climate, and that this carbon dioxide has been... Exactly, this carbon dioxide has been produced by human activity. And I think, although we could spend more than 3 hours going through why this is patent nonsense, and we would probably get, if this was a mainstream audience, we would get scientists ringing in to say that this was completely wrong and the science was settled, etc., etc. I think for me personally, I get extremely frustrated when people feel that they can have a conclusion about something when they ignore 50% or more of the available evidence, which proves that their conclusions must be wrong, or at least cannot be as conclusive as they would contend. So I'm going to basically start off until I get some music, and maybe just read through for a few minutes something which I wrote in 2009 originally, and this was written in response to one of these aforementioned public consultation meetings at the Royal Society. And before I do that, I will just describe my experience there. And if you know where to look, you can hear me reading out a short an address, I suppose you might say, which they almost didn't allow me to do when I was in this meeting, but it has fortunately been archived, in which I warned the people present, or I basically reminded them of a warning, I should say, that was given by President Eisenhower in 1961. And he warned in his speech about the military-industrial complex, and Dr. Wood and I have spoken about this before, how we could be held hostage to a scientific technological elite. And I think this phrase, scientific technological elite, is something that is that phrase that Eisenhower used is very rarely used and very rarely considered, in that what if these people that are setting... stating all these things that are allegedly scientifically proven are not actually proven, and the examples of that, again, is 9/11, where they produced these technical reports, which were just basically totally incorrect. They were scientifically incorrect. Yet we have this elite, this scientific technological elite, so that you might. You call it as Eisenhower did, that now says, well, that is the truth, get used to it, don't challenge it, essentially, that's what it's saying. So I'll read something from this document that I wrote, and I've called the document Reinvestigating Climate Change. And as I say, this was written in response to a public consultation meeting, because they were asking for members of the public to submit their thoughts about the so-called climate change issue. So this is what I wrote in this document, which is about 20 pages long, and it's mainly pictures, actually. For much of the last 20 years, the debate about what is most affecting our climate has been raging. More recently, it seems, certain groups within mainstream science and academia have gained, quote, the upper hand, close quote, and the wider population appear to have accepted their flawed conclusions. These conclusions have then been used to set public policy in governments around the world. This has happened despite the repeated reports of a failure to agree various environmental targets at a number of so-called climate summits that have taken place over the last few years, such as the one in Kyoto, which I think was in 1992, and Copenhagen, which was later. I haven't got the dates for these right in front of me, but you can check these up. And I've referenced all of this in this document that I've produced. And so we have these climate summits. A troubling development in the last few years has been the open discussion of geoengineering, modifying the Earth's climate directly by one means or another. And then I talk about what I call catastrophism and the techniques of divide and conquer, and what I call the control group, which goes under many names. It seems to be true that if you tell people their way of life is under threat and you present them with some vaguely plausible story as to how you know this is true, they will become easier to manipulate. They may question you about your conclusions, and if you can answer their questions in a credible way, you will gain their confidence and, as a consequence, gain power over them. This is this scientific technological elite to which Eisenhower referred. However, it seems that to really understand what is happening in climate science, one has to entertain that there is indeed an overall control group which has an agenda. That agenda is one of gaining increased power and control over the lives of ordinary people. With research and campaign groups polarized, it becomes much easier to hide the control group's identity and even hide the very idea of the control group's existence. The task of concealment is therefore assisted by a process of creating factions within the general populace who sit on either side of an issue and expend their energies arguing or even attacking each other. Whilst attention is focused on the squabbles, the control group can carry out its agenda, whilst most people are blind to the evidence which betrays the control group's reality. And in this document I reference Dr. Wood's study of Hurricane Erin as the clearest evidence of the reality of some kind of powerful control group of unknown identity is shown in that data, I would argue. Most people are also blind to the operation of the control group's tactics to hide their own existence and identity, and they're blind to the control group's ability to confuse or confound anyone trying to uncover more information about the control group itself. Some people become seduced by the wish for more power and influence, and then perhaps are unwittingly co-opted into the larger agenda. Some people feel, for reasons discussed later in the document, they are helping the Earth, or the planet, or the environment, or they are helping to create a positive future. So I'm trying to express here, people, you know, want to end pollution, and they want to, you know, create clean energy sources, and we have this phrase which has been used, sustainable living, and this has come out of something called Agenda 21. If you look into that. And then I want to talk about attitudes to those people like me. I do have some background in science and engineering, so I do have some knowledge of these things because of my own work in the past in these areas. Typically, when data like that shown in the document that I'm referring to, which is called Reinvestigating Climate Change, it's on my website, is or are brought up or discussed, there is a huge adverse reaction to that data, and a big fight ensues. And you can see a typical example of this from a few years ago in a TV interview with Ed Begley and Stuart Varney of Fox News, where Varney asks if the science about climate change is conclusive and he challenges various statements made by Ed Begley. Begley states, "You're spewing your nonsense again." I wonder if some of this stems from what is discussed in section later in the document. So what I'm asking there is people become attached to certain sets of data, and they will vigorously stick with that data even when it can be shown that that is incomplete and there are other factors that must be taken into account. Similarly, what's been happening with this issue in the mainstream media, people who are not scientists have made widely read comments which do not address any of the data which I talk about. For example, Paul McCartney in an interview compares global warming skeptics, which is a label given by the mainstream media, to Holocaust deniers. So he's using an emotive argument to try and discredit those who present other data which proves that this CO2 business isn't the whole story. For those who are naturally sceptical, sniggers or cries of phrases such as conspiracy theory or tinfoil hat often serve to discourage renewed, reasoned, and dispassionate analysis of the evidence. This, it seems, is an example of how group mentality can be influenced and moulded. You use these labels and attach them to people or groups to stop people looking at the actual evidence they're talking about. It should be borne in mind that finding the truth demands a most vigorous application of energy and time to investigate what is truly happening, and this investigation must take place with a clear and stated independence from corporate and other vested interests, and without recourse to either invective or preconceived notions. Now, a clear thing with the climate change issue is that we must be clear in distinguishing between environmental damage and climate change. There is no doubt that human activity is damaging the environment. For example, industrial pollution and industrialized fishing and agricultural practices have, it is clear, destroyed habitat. They've caused extinction of a number of species of flora and fauna in various ways and for various reasons. With the real damage caused on a daily and large-scale basis, it is easy to manipulate people's emotions, fears, and environmental conscience when presenting these matters without proper distinction between environmental damage and climate change. In other words, just because we happen to, or companies, large companies, happen to be, you know, drilling oil and creating pollution with various chemicals that are used in the environment, does not necessarily prove that that is affecting the climate. And also that applies to the production of CO2.
Yeah, I'd like to insert an example, like in the Gulf of Mexico, the naturally occurring tar balls.
Yep.
That come out of the salt domes and other things that, you know, in the Gulf, it gets confused with, you know, polluting oil wells.
I think that's an extremely good example, because then the environmentalist will make an argument that the oil has destroyed the environment, and, you know, then the people that know about these tar balls will point out, no, in this particular instance, this is a natural thing that's, you know,
and there's a naturally occurring bacteria that eats the tar balls because it's been there for, you know,
yeah,
centuries and centuries,
and it's part of the ecosystem, you know, in that area, and that's right. So people confuse these, and because it's an emotionally charged issue, they can't divorce themselves from the situation. You know, they see all the dead fish, or, you know, things like dead dolphins, or horrible things like this, and
lightning strikes.
Yeah,
they start fires where you need a fire to get more seedlings and, you know, for a turnover in the forest.
So it's easy to present emotive arguments by selectively using certain types of image, certain types of imagery, and this sort of thing. And you have to look at all of the evidence to get to the truth on matters such as this. And I just read on a little bit more from this. There's not much more. This is the introduction to this document. And the rest of it actually is mostly pictures. Most people have at least some awareness of the effects of their lifestyle on the environment, though these effects are often hidden, except when large numbers of people are affected by such things as dumping of industrial waste, depletion of fish stocks, or intensive farming practices. Is it any wonder that some websites promote the AGW myth, which means anthropic global warming, which is this idea that human activity generates CO2, which creates a warmer climate? They promote this idea out of love for the environment, but that's not a good basis on which to do it. You have to promote it on the basis of evidence. Also, we must make a distinction between local and global climate changes. For example, the urban heat island effect is well understood and the data is clear. The same conclusion by definition cannot apply on a global scale because an island is not a globe. And we'll talk to you after the break. Hello there. Good evening, good morning, wherever you are in the world. My name is Andrew Johnson, and I have with me on today's program Dr. Judy Wood, and we're having a general discussion, which is actually mainly me talking right now, but we're going to have a bit more of a discussion in a few minutes. And if you wanted to call in the final hour, there is a call-in number, and we'd like you to keep the questions tightly focused and perhaps discussing some of the issues we've been discussing tonight. And the call-in number is 1-800-313-9443. And you can visit our websites. Checktheevidence.com is my website, and Dr. Judy Wood's website is drjudywood.com, or you can look at the website for Dr. Judy Wood's book, Where Did the Towers Go?, which is wheredidthetowersgo.com, not surprisingly. And we've been talking about, well, I've been talking about something called geoengineering, which is related to so-called climate change. And I was talking before the break, reading from this document I'd written a few years ago called Reinvestigating Climate Change, and you can download that document from my website free. I hope that you'll do that, because I think I've tried to put quite a number of issues together in this into about, it's actually 40 pages when you print it out in A5. It's if you print it out on letter size paper, it's about 20 pages, but it's mostly pictures. And I was talking about how there seems to be a hidden control group which is essentially trying to keep the idea of geoengineering, that's, you know, ongoing geoengineering, hidden. And they're wrapping this up in talk of climate change and having these opposing factions of the climate change groups and this sort of thing, and keeping the actual truth of what's going on hidden. And I wanted to just carry on reading a little bit more, not much more, from this document. I talked about the urban heat island effect, for example. People know about that. That's been known about for, I think, decades, where this is where cities, for example, are maybe 1 or 2 degrees warmer than rural areas. The average temperature over a city will be, because, you know, you've got concrete structures and asphalt, which is absorbing the heat from the sun, and over a period of time, you know, you get this, like, storage heater effect, and that keeps the cities just 1 or 2, maybe a few more degrees warmer than the sort of rural areas. So that's well known. But people then want to extend that to the globe and say the globe is warming. Well, an island is not a globe, you know, that's simple as that. Nowadays, when some people suggest that changes in the weather are not caused by industrial pollution, it is assumed they are somehow suggesting we should not worry about the wholesale pollution of our environment. So this is the confusion between the global warming issue and the destruction of the environment. We have to separate those two issues. Or it is tacitly assumed that those suggesting other causes for changes in the climate are saying that humanity should not worry about the effects of its activities on the environment. And I'm not saying that. I think we should be very careful about all of the resources that we use. So because of the increase in invisibility of environmental organisations and issues in the last 30 or 40 years, it becomes easier to marginalise legitimate scientific questions raised by people who remain sceptical or remain unconvinced that the carbon dioxide emissions specifically from human industrial activity have had any provable effect on global climate in the last 150 years. In other words, what I'm saying is, you show a few pictures of some chimneys belching out, you know, fumes and smoke, and you show, you know, some polluted lakes or something like that, and you can then immediately...
And then you tell people to connect the dots.
Yeah, you put some captions under it, or an article, or you write an article about how the global temperature measured by such and such a scale has gone up, and people believe it. Now, there is no doubt that carbon dioxide output has increased due to industrialization. But in this document, and it's elsewhere, it's not just me that's done this, there's lots of research that shows this. You need to properly study the data, which proves that the climate change issue is much more complicated than is generally spoken of. And extra carbon dioxide from industrialization is probably the least significant issue, and therefore the perfect disguise for any of the control groups' agenda. And what you'll find is that when they talk of this global warming, by CO2. It's all based on modeling. It's not really based on observation, because even this idea of calculating the global temperature, it's hugely complicated, the way that you choose to average the data. You can change that.
I'd like to insert something here. Is, you know, what you learn in elementary school when you start learning how to graph things. If you have two data points that are nanometer apart, and you try to draw a straight line through them and extrapolate it 10 miles out, it's going to be real important as exactly what...
Hello. Good morning, good evening, good afternoon, wherever you are in the world. My name is Andrew Johnson, and I have with me Dr. Judy Wood, and we are currently sort of having a bit of a discussion, mainly me talking at the minute, from a document which I wrote called Reinvestigating Climate Change, and we're talking a little bit about that, and we're talking about geoengineering, which I'm going to try and get onto a little bit more shortly. And before the break, Dr. Wood was starting to talk about, because I'd made this point that a lot of the this global warming debate is based on modeling rather than observation, and I'd made this point that they talk about the average global temperature, and how you actually measure this is you know, there are probably 500 different ways of averaging out the global temperature, and Dr. Wood was starting to make this point about the way that you draw a best fit line, I think, if I remember what she was saying correctly.
The simplest model is a straight line, and I think we all remember from elementary school drawing a straight line through two data points. If those data points are a nanometer apart, can you extrapolate it out 10 miles with any kind of reasonable, understanding? Also, how long have we been able to record temperatures to 0.0001 degrees Fahrenheit accuracy?
Absolutely, and that's... Yeah, absolutely.
How long have we had satellites that can tell us where there's a hurricane out in the middle of the ocean that we otherwise wouldn't see unless it made landfall?
Exactly, and I mean, we know that the first satellite was Sputnik back in 1957, which of course was a very simple radio transmitter. That's all it was. I'm pretty sure it didn't have any sensing on it. So we know that the satellite records, for example, only go back to maybe the early 60s. Exactly, in our lifetime. I mean, there are other ground-based records, but they're very, very isolated. So we have to be aware that some of this, the claims being made by these scientists are not really based on a lot of measurement, and not as much as they would have us believe. And, I also have the question that with the CO2 measurements, is that this CO2, the way that this is measured, how do they know which CO2 is produced by industrial processes and how much has come out of the inside of a volcano? Because when a volcano erupts, and you can look at the data for this, it emits an enormous amount of carbon dioxide, hundreds of years worth of equivalent to what factories would produce. If you added all the factories together on Earth, a couple of volcanic eruptions will produce more CO2 than all the factories on the Earth put together, in 50 or 100 years. So how do you distinguish between those two things? That's something that's not discussed. And when I went to this meeting in 2009, there was some young lady, she produced these graphs about her predictions for global temperature, and they went 3,000 years into the future.
Drawing a straight line through data points that are a nanometer apart.
There you go. And these graphs, frankly, to me, look ridiculous. So we must be aware that whatever claims are made for this data, it is not supportable. It is not supportable. And I won't go through the rest of this document, because I think it's much better if people want to read this, they read this themselves, because I cover a number of topics, including these so-called chemtrails that people have talked about. I talk about what are called chemtrails or persistent jet trails, which I've since done a lot more research on. But one thing I would like to mention, and I mentioned it to Dr. Wood briefly as we were talking before the program, is this so-called global warming and climate change, which has been happening throughout the solar system. And a good chunk of the document, I show you the pictures from the Hubble Space Telescope, and mainly the Hubble Space Telescope, actually, a couple of amateur pictures, where you can actually see changes in the climate on other planets way out in the solar system, which we know cannot have been caused by carbon dioxide from human activity.
Also, we know, you know, the factory output and so forth of modern man, how did that cause the melting away from the ice age?
Exactly. I mean, there are other factors such as that. And then in the document, I discuss the so-called Maunder Minimum, and I mention the medieval warming period, which most of these scientists that talk about CO2-driven climate change don't talk about. They won't talk about that. And I think also, we should remind people about some of the data that you came across. I think it was back in 2008, which, you know, I don't know if you would argue the way that I do, but I think this to me is clear evidence of something very fishy, which I would argue is an instance of geoengineering. And I think the fact that people will not talk about this.
I think the way, you know, I look at it, the most simple, unassuming way is, you know, hurricanes show up on weather maps. Why would they hide them? And don't they warn people when a hurricane's coming? If they can't predict the weather, as is the common thought, then they should tell people, well, maybe, you know, this is voluntary evacuation right now. Let's wait and see how it gets closer before we have mandatory evacuation. But when they don't give that option at all, and you have the Category 3 hurricane headed straight to Manhattan, where you have, you know, millions of people, you can't evacuate them in 1 hour's time. And nothing is said. That leads me to conclude that they have 100% control of that hurricane.
You are led to that conclusion, I think, and I would agree with you on that. I mean, one of the things that we cannot say is if it indeed was steered, which to me I think it must have been steered the way that if you look at the past, we don't know how that was done. We don't have the evidence to say how it was done, but if you look at what you just said there, right there, and
they're
other
not
factors,
worried.
they don't appear to have been worried. It appears that they they didn't totally cover it up, but when we looked at the local news reports for that area that could have been affected by the hurricane, I sampled four news reports from the Internet Archive. And two of the news reports out of the four don't even mention Hurricane Erin, which is what we're talking about, which was this
it's
hurricane.
It's not an icon on the weather map, and
so the weather's nice as can be. Yet this thing had actually, correct me if I'm wrong, been moving towards New York City in a straight line for 4 days prior to these reports going out on the TV.
Mm-hmm. The space station film from Frank Culberson.
That's
now
right.
Now look down the East Coast, see if I see anything else. And I'm feeling sorry. You can see the carnage down there on the ground. This is the morning of 9/11 where he's saying this. And he doesn't notice that he has to aim his camera to avoid the bands of the hurricane. You'd think he'd say, well, gee, those people, at least, you know, it could have been worse, and they lucked out here.
Yeah, I mean, it's this odd expression, I'm looking up and down the East Coast to see if I can see anything else. Well, why would you be even looking for anything else if you're so concerned about what's happened in New York, you know? And what would he expect to see from space? You can't see, you know, you can't see planes from space without high-powered optical equipment. You know, so what would he expect to see? You know, it's a curious turn of phrase that he uses. So
he probably couldn't see up and down the East Coast because the hurricane was so big he couldn't see through it.
Yeah, exactly. And I think what really bugs me, and I'm a little bit irked because somebody on Facebook that I've corresponded with a few times, and I actually chatted to him on Skype for a couple of hours, probably 2 or 3 years ago now. And he is a chap called Max Bliss, and we talked about some of this, and we talked about Hurricane Erin and how, you know, it does seem to have some correspondence with the events of 9/11, which some of that information is well, in fact probably most of it is covered in Dr. Wood's book, so that people can make their own judgment on how it was involved and see how it was involved, or see how it appears to have been involved.
Phenomenal coincidence.
Exactly. And this Max Bliss character, you know, he talks all about, chemtrails and these other instances of geoengineering and so forth. Doesn't talk about Hurricane Erin. And yet I've seen him recently in the last couple of days. He's posted 2 9/11 videos. The latest one that he posted today included this Stephen E. Jones character who's set up this thermite disinformation back in 2005. Which I was suckered into. So why do... this is my question. Why do people who talk about 9/11 not talk about Hurricane Erin? Why do people who talk about geoengineering not even consider that Hurricane Erin could be one of the strongest bits of evidence that geoengineering was done as part of the operation of 9/11? Why do they not talk about
it? It definitely would imply foreknowledge if that's the case.
Yeah, so then people do not talk about this. And Dr. Wood and myself and Richard D. Hall, our good friend who's done all the TV programs with us and has been he's been a key person in raising the awareness of some of what I'm telling you, is Richard D. Hall in the UK. Who else talks about this? Almost nobody.
Andrew, I think you came up with the exact reason. Thou shalt not combine.
Yes.
You don't want people to make connections. As long as you keep people on single issues and they don't connect things.
That appears to be exactly what is going on, that you keep people focused on one or two issues and then you don't get this kind of more integrated picture. And
because that requires thinking, and people start seeing what's happening. They start being able to see more and more if they give themselves permission to see how things are interrelated.
Yes, and what I'm going to go on to talk about how this knowledge begins to affect you and what effects it can have on you. And I've got some quotes from other people which I've been talking to over the last few years, which I'm also going to read out, because some of them are quite significant in what this means for all of us. Because geoengineering, why I want to bring this up, is it's not talked about that much, but it is an issue which transcends everything. It affects everybody on the planet. It affects all life on the planet. It affects life in the sea. It's not like, it's not like money. It's not like politics. It affects everything. It affects the way that we live. It affects the way that we can grow food. It affects everything. And I think the technology involved, I would argue, affects the way that we can generate energy, and even affects, for example, the way that we could use it for propulsion and travel away from the Earth. And all of that comes into it.
I'd like to add one more thing to something you said earlier about getting people to fight about things. One of the biggest problems is keeping people away from developing their problem-solving skills. And one of the biggest things I emphasize with 9/11 is you first determine what happened before you talk about how it happened. You have to determine what it is that happened. And if you get people to focus on how it happened, they have to assume what it was. So you have a variety of assumptions, and the real problem never gets solved. So you have people arguing about their assumptions.
And
I think that works with everything.
It does, and I think the global warming issue is one of the biggest current examples in the scientific community of that process going on, and has been going on for 20 years.
Because they feed you, how before they tell you, before you understand what the problem actually is.
And I mean, I remember, for example, going into some of this particular issue a little bit, this climate gate, as it was called, and this Hadley Climate Research Unit, which is based at the University of East Anglia in the UK, they've admitted science fraud. They've admitted massaging the data to fit their model. That was admitted, and it was admitted in emails which were leaked around the time of the Copenhagen summit in 2009. And one of the people that covered that was a fellow called James Corbett. James Corbett, who has, you know, become one of these alternative news reporters, and he even covered this climate gate number two, as he called it. I don't know if that was his name or for it or somebody else's, but this was the issue, that they have this famous hockey stick graph, which is allegedly showing the increase in global temperature because of the increase in CO2. But it later transpired that they model, or the equations that they use to generate this graph, you could put any data into that equation, and it would generate this hockey stick shape. That was what was allegedly said later on, and this became public knowledge that this hockey stick was meaningless, and James Corbett made big fanfare of this. But James Corbett, again, will not talk about 9/11. He publicly has ridiculed the research of my co-host, Dr. Judy Wood, and you can see that on his website. So why would he do that? Why would he do that? Well, when he's talking, and he's obviously done a lot of research into the climate issue, and he's also done research into the events of 9/11 and has spoken. He even made like one of these 10-minute bullet point videos about 9/11. Why would he not talk about this? Well, I know the answer to that, or I know the result of him not talking about it, and that's it. He's become part of the cover-up of the events of 9/11. So,
I wonder if you don't become part of the cover-up, do you get wiped off the map?
This is the question: why do people become part of the cover-up? And we can talk about the reasons for that probably most of the rest of the program, but I think it's a mixture of reasons. But in this document, the document that I call Reinvestigating Climate Change, I talk about the fraud in the Anthropic Global Warming group. And then, for example, I mention Dr. Judy Wood's Hurricane Erin study. You see the pictures of that. You'll see the pictures from around the solar system. You'll also see the pictures of various weather anomalies, which are just a few, and I've gathered probably quite a few more since. And I've been seeing those here quite recently, just in the last couple of days. I've seen, for example, clouds going across in an exactly east-west direction with a linear straight-edge ruler sort of appearance. And you can find videos of this on YouTube from around the world. You can find these strange hole punch clouds. Go and look for these. They're very little discussed in this context. And we've got a break coming up now, so we'll speak to you again after that. Okay, just had a slight problem with my headset. Just had to get that sorted out. Hear me now? Hello, good evening. Wherever you are around the world, I'm just a little bit caught on the hop there because I had a slight problem with my headset. And my name is Andrew Johnson, as you probably now know. And we are here with Dr. Judy Wood. We've got a very short segment now, just a couple of minutes before we have yet another break. And we were talking about the 9/11 and the cover-up. And I'm going to talk a little bit more about that because I've had some feedback on how people feel when they realize the extent of the cover-up, and they also realize what actually happened at the World Trade Center, which is I can't really overstate the significance of what happened there and the enormous world-changing significance of what actually happened there and what's revealed in Dr. Wood's book. Now, I think one of the things that comes up as well is that, you know, we sometimes get people writing to us and making sort of various critical comments, or, you know, saying, oh, I like your theory, or I like your view, or this, that, and the rest of it. Or they'll say other things, say, have you thought of this, or have you thought of that? And then we ask them about their background. Or this has certainly happened in my case a few times. You ask them about their background and why they might be asking these questions and why they're not grasping what the evidence shows, and they become quite defensive, and they may even sort of chastise you for asking about such things. I had one like this the other day on a related topic. And I wanted to point out that both myself and Dr. Wood, we've essentially become public figures. Not in the sense of, you know, sort of these regular mainstream scientists or celebrities or anything like that, but we have enough videos of ourselves and interviews and audios of ourselves on the internet, and of course this is now be added to that collection. This will now be added to that collection, that people should be able to get an impression of what we are like as people, at least to some extent, from listening to those interviews. And they should be able to work out fairly well, I think, if they study enough, that, you know, what we're actually saying, whether it's true or not, and whether we are sincere. And I know this might sound like I'm rambling a bit, and perhaps I am, but I want to talk more about this after the next break, because I want to make a point to some of these people that approach us mainly anonymously. So we'll speak to you after the next break.
Are tuned in to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Visit our website by going to republicbroadcasting.org.
Okay, so good morning, good evening, good afternoon, wherever you are in the world. My name is Andrew Johnson, and I have a website called checktheevidence.com. You can contact me through that website if you wish. I have with me Dr. Judy Wood, and she has a website called drjudywood.com. We are currently filling in for Deanna Spingola, who has kindly offered us this slot as she is otherwise engaged today. And we're talking about the 9/11 cover-up, and I've pointed out that myself and Dr. Wood, we've essentially become public figures talking about this issue, and we then encounter a number of kind of, I suppose, kind of sort of logistical problems when people write to us or try and talk to us, and for example, they will characterize what Dr. Wood has written or posted or, you know, put into a public presentation as a view or an opinion when it is no such thing. It's actually a set of evidence. And, you know, sometimes when we try and point this out to people, they don't seem to understand, or they will disagree with this. In other words, it's not a point of view, going back to what I said earlier about whether the towers turn to dust or not. It's actually an observation. And people should understand that. They need to understand that difference. And also, following on from that, you know, we have to point out some of our own experience. Dr. Wood is a scientist. She has been involved for literally decades in scientific research in her field of expertise. And I think before, you know, I'll get Dr. Wood to comment on this, but what I wanted to point out is that in the age of the internet, that somehow now becomes devalued, because people think they can thoroughly know about a topic just by maybe watching a couple of YouTube videos, or, you know, reading a couple of Wikipedia pages or whatever. But that, of course, doesn't count the same in the same way as having decades of research experience. For myself, it's slightly different. I don't have decades of scientific research experience, but I do have decades of experience of working in an engineering discipline, which involves technical analysis and gathering information to solve problems. That's been my background for a total period of about just over 20 years. So I have that experience. I have the experience of actually taking information, breaking it apart, finding the errors in it, fixing it back up again to fix a problem. Dr. Wood, in her own areas of expertise, has had to do that sort of thing to solve various problems, to research. In her own area of expertise, she's had to make things, she's had to build things, she's had to re-engineer things to make them work the way that she's needed them to work to complete her research tasks.
Or to understand, you know, what it is you're looking at. And you keep, you know, researching until you figure it out.
So I just wanted to make a couple of points quickly that is not the same as watching a YouTube video. You develop an innate understanding, and you can even develop an intuition for whether something is going to be worth looking at or worth studying more, and this sort of thing. So you have all that experience, and that cannot be overridden just by, you know, a couple of emails and a couple of, you know, watching a couple of YouTube videos. And we, you know, we are publicly recognized for that. And some of these people that contact us, what research have you done? Have you published it on a website? Have you taken it to court? And then, of course, the silence that comes back is usually pretty comprehensive silence on those sorts of issues. But just before I'm sure Dr. Wood will have many comments on this, but I just wanted to make the point that we've now reached a situation where, because of things like, you know, I've talked a lot earlier on about the climate change issue, that is an area where many people now no longer trust, and rightfully so in that particular case, much of what the scientific community puts out, because what they put out is not really scientific research, it's propaganda. This presents people like us with a problem, because they can get into the situation where, oh, you've got a PhD, well, we don't trust you because you've been brainwashed by the scientific establishment. So we've got a double-edged sword with this here. And so anyway, I've said what I wanted to say, and Dr. Wood, I think, wants to follow up with some comments.
It's something along the same lines that I was contacted by a reporter, you know, whatever happened to investigative journalism, a reporter who wanted to do a video about the cover-up. And so why talk about the cover-up? You talk about what actually happened that is knowable. And, you know, there are facts. And, oh, that's just your views. We want to talk about your views as well as other views. Well, if you talk about a gazillion views, it does absolutely nothing for the audience. You know, okay, 2 + 3 = 7, 2 + 3 = 9, somebody else says 2 + 3 = 5, somebody else says 2 + 3 = 8. I guess we'll never know what 2 + 3 is. There's just no consensus. That's what gets presented to the audience. And it's an injustice. But what really it comes down to is this person does not have degrees in civil engineering, engineering mechanics, materials engineering science, doesn't have 40 years experience in forensic engineering and science, has not researched this project for over 10 years, hasn't even read the report.
Yeah, I mean, this is the problem, really, that you have to look at the evidence, and you have to look at it in, you know, from a context of knowing, you know, for example, in your case, knowing how materials behave. You knew how those materials should behave in those circumstances, because, you know, those were things that you taught classes about, you know.
But I'm also used to observing, and I see a material coming apart into dust. I mean, it jumps out at you. Other people would look at it and say, well, I know this, this, and this. It doesn't fit in those, you know, it must be one of those categories, so therefore it's a collapse because that's all I know exists. Instead, I look at what is the material doing? And I can see what it's doing. I don't have to have the explanation as to why, but I can see it's turning into dust in midair.
And absolutely, and you know, you illustrated that to me, you know, years ago now, and I'd never originally seen that, despite, you know, I have a knowledge of physics and so forth, but I didn't have that detailed knowledge, probably, of how to observe things in the physical, you know, in a physical sense, in that sort of environment. It's not something I'd actually done very much of, certainly not as much as you had. So, you know, you educated me in that regard. And I think this is one of the issues. People have to be willing to be educated. They have to be willing to learn.
And
that requires something I haven't mentioned. That requires a type of humility. And humility is not a quality which is available, or not available, that's the wrong word, but I don't think it's seen widely enough. Not many people have humility. It's a word, also a word which is not used very much. You know, we're often taught to be adversarial, and we're taught to be confrontational, but rarely do we see examples of humility, you know, and sort of be, because, for example, politicians, if they were to say, oh, sorry, I got that wrong, you know, and I need to change what I said because it was wrong, that's seen as a sign of weakness, you know, to not vote for that person.
And that soundbite would be played and played and played over and over again by their opposition.
Yeah, you know, and we have this idea of a U-turn and stuff like that, you know. But unless you're willing to learn, you know, and we know that most of the people in the world are mistaken about what they understand happened on 9/11. We know that because we know what happened, and that yet then again you get into this idea that, you know, we're accused of being arrogant because we say no, that we know what happened. Well, it's not really arrogant to say that you've studied something. You know, it's not really arrogant for a police investigator to say, well, I know how this person was killed because I've investigated it. You know, it's their job. You know, it's what they've been tasked with doing. And although we haven't been given this as a job, we've taken it upon ourselves essentially as a public, as a job, as a service to the public, you know. And so we do have some expertise. I don't have the same expertise as you, but hopefully I have expertise in at least, you know, communicating some of this information at the very least to other people, because that's been some of what I've done. So you know, this is what people have to consider. And when we get attacked by anonymous people that don't have qualifications, or if they do, they're unwilling to disclose what they are, you know, and they're not willing to disclose what problem they're trying to solve. This is a common one we ask people as well. You know, if you say this is wrong, and you come out and say this is just an opinion, well, what problem are you trying to solve? Do you want to actually know what happened? Do you know what, how do you think you know what happened? You know, what do you think happened?
Yeah, do you even want to solve the problem?
Do you even want to solve the problem?
The reporter has the choice now. They could read the report if they want to know what happened. But if they don't want to know what happened, they won't.
No, and have they even defined the problem that they're trying to solve? In other words, you know, are they going to look at what happened to the World Trade Center, or are they going to try and look at the events at the other sites on 9/11? You know, that some people don't even think about that.
They just want ratings.
They just want ratings, or Facebook likes, or YouTube views, or, you know, to sell books, or whatever it is. You know, essentially, you know, the thing about you and I is we both have been involved in education. I'm still on a sort of low level involved in education part time. So, you know, one of my part time jobs is a tutor. I try and, you know, I'm supposed to explain things to my students and get them to understand. And that's exactly the same approach that I adopt when somebody writes to me. If they're genuine with their inquiry, you know, I will try and illustrate to them, you know, an answer their question. But other people apparently are not like that. We do have this huge cover-up ongoing, and it is being operated by evil forces. I think that's something that you come to realize, and it uses various tactics up to and including mind control And naive
people don't realize when they're being manipulated. They're given a list of talking points that they repeat and repeat without even paying attention to what the talking points are. My favorite one was got repeated over and over again, and initially by Stephen Jones, saying that there's steel-toed boots that were melting. Until I started saying, wait a minute, if my steel oven is melting, the turkey inside is more than well done. Yet we have no reports of burned feet. But that line had been repeated in an amazing amount of time, just like all the steel was shipped to China. In 5 minutes?
That's it, and it's a simple technique for training people is just by hourly repetition of a statement, you know, like climate change or global warming or, you know, whatever it is. People become hypnotized.
There must be truth to it if somebody's saying it.
It must be true. If you have some, you know, professor on TV talking about climate change, then what he's saying must be true. Obviously, I'm oversimplifying. But I think, again, I'd like to read out a couple of messages I've received, not recently, but over the. I just thought I'd put into this program we were doing today. And I think when you realize the truth about what happened at the World Trade Center, and it kind of sinks in, and this can take actually a period of time up to a couple of years, I think, to really.
I'd like to insert one thing here. A lot of people want to know when I'm going to have an electronic version of my book. I'm not, because there's something special about having it in your hands. You sit on the sofa and you read a paragraph, and then you look out in the space and you contemplate on what you just read. Hmm. Plus, you know, you don't have anyone to save face to. When somebody reads online, they tend to scan, or electronically, and they do, data mining or whatever with word searching, and just read one little segment instead of understanding the whole story. But the idea of holding a book in your hand, being able to think about and contemplate what you're reading is so important.
Yes, and I think there are, you know, that's absolutely right, and I think there are a number of other reasons why an e-book wouldn't really work as well, and, mm-hmm. you know, it's also much easier to kind of hack it and change it and kind of release,
a
fraudulent version or a doctored version or something, and it may be done in very subtle ways. This is something that I've written a little bit about in a slightly different context that I've encountered related to 9/11 research, though. But just this idea of actually realizing the truth and knowing what's going on. I spoke about this to somebody else, and it's kind of when you realize this, you're thrown into a different place, and it's like there's this wall between you and other people. And Claudia, a lady, wrote to me, and she said that this was exactly her experience. Following reading a book by Rosalie Bertell, where she, you know, came to the conclusion that, for example, the earthquake in Haiti, I haven't come to this conclusion myself, but she really felt that this was deliberately caused, the earthquake in Haiti, and there are some peculiar effects around that, but she said that since then, and this is how I felt, since then, and since my realization of what happened at the World Trade Center and how it was done with the energy weapon, I have been living beyond the barrier and cannot be heard or understood by anyone on the normal side, the other side of the barrier. The change happened like an earthquake within my body. I fell ill. When I got up, everything had changed. It was like a call from the spiritual world, she said. This is Claudia's words, not mine. The Earth herself also. This is why I founded the planetary movement for Mother Earth. She felt that there was something going on with this, you know, planetary consciousness. I think there's something along those lines going on too, but I'm not going to go into that here. I thought it could be the means to move other people over the barrier as well, and it is my experience as well that I failed in trying to do so until now. And so she's talking about this, you end up in this place where you can't communicate with other people any longer because you know things that they can't appreciate, they can't get to. And then Atahan is one of the members of the Facebook group that we post on called Real 9/11 Truth. He'd written a similar theme, and he said that you want to bring your loved ones with you, but you can't. And this is, I think that's a very simple statement, but it's, in many cases it's true. You know, a lot of my family have no clue about the significance of this, and I can't really seem to get it across to them. Because when you get passionate about something, and you try to kind of, you know, convey how important this is, it puts people off. They cannot go there, and I think it was...
Or more than that, they have to be ready to go there, because yes. They start going that direction, and they see the implications, and they can't handle it, and they're scared to death, and they run the other direction, and they're afraid to death of getting near that wall. And they have to be ready to get there. And if they're not, there's nothing much you can do, I think.
And going on back to what Claudia was saying, she writes, an argument against the journey is this. What would people do with the knowledge as they cannot do anything against the perpetrators? In other words, what do we do against these people with this technology? Who knows? Only when being clear about the reality can we start to think and act properly. Without that, we would always be behind, hopelessly lost in confusion. So this is, I think, one of the key things. We're still at this realization stage, and one of the things I wanted to say earlier, but didn't, was going to just mention about the JFK assassination. The problem as I see it, for example, is if we look at the JFK assassination, we know that this story of Oswald isn't true, and I'll perhaps if I have time mention a little bit more about what I've read recently, but that official story has essentially lasted 50 years. No one really, apart from, I think, Clay Shaw, has ever been charged with any crimes in connection with the assassination of President Kennedy, and he was one of the most powerful men in the world. He, in other words, was probably not a member of this elite group. He was somehow outside of it. And what did they do? They killed him. So people have to realize what the enemy is capable of, and somehow we've got to, I don't know how we do it, but we have to be able to transcend that situation.
It also, the objective is not revenge. It isn't about getting someone, because if you get the person who pushed the button to operate it, there's another one waiting to sit down and operate the machinery too.
So that seems to be the case.
If the technology exists, that's the issue. You know, you can have any number of operators.
Yes, yes. And then I had another little quote from Etahan, who said that you experience a kind of sorrow as you watch others get their psychology operated on, and all you can do is watch. You can't seem to, you know, show them and illustrate to them what's happening, because they're not receptive or not able to receive what you're saying. Hello, good morning, good evening, good afternoon, wherever you are in the world. My name is Andrew Johnson, and I have with me Dr. Judy Wood. We are just filling in for a few more minutes now for Diana Spingola, who will be back on her next program. She's otherwise engaged today, so we were asked to fill in for Diana, and she will be back next time. So I just started to read. I was a little caught out with the timing. And I was talking about the cover-up of 9/11 and how, you know, one can feel when one realizes what the truth is. And we have a Facebook group called 9/11 Real Truth. And a number of people in there have expressed their, you know, angst about not being able to communicate this knowledge to other people and its significance. And Atahan, who's a member of that group, he actually said to me in one message that he described knowing this truth, knowing that there is this technology which is real, that it's an immaculate burden. I think this is an interesting phrase that he's used, in that we know the truth, but it is kind of a burden to know it as well. And so I just wanted to make that point. And I believe that we have a caller. We will probably get some time with this caller, which I think is Philip in, I think in North Carolina, if I've got that right. So maybe we can talk to Philip now and get some chat in before the break.
Yes, sir, this is me. Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Yes, we can hear you. Great. Hello. Thanks for calling in.
Well, it certainly is an honor to get a chance to speak with the both of you at the same time. This is my first time, I believe, conversating with Andrew. And I've had the fortune of being able to talk to Dr. Wood on the phone. I think it was a couple of years back on the a program that I believe Character Driven Media produced. So it certainly is a pleasure to get to speak with you two.
Oh, great. Yeah, did you want to sort of have a question or anything, or did you just say
no? I do have a question, actually. After coming to understand the information that Dr. Wood has put out there for us, I found myself gravitating towards other researchers, and I actually wanted to ask, if I could, your opinions about these researchers.
Mm-hmm.
Number one being Mark Passio, number two being Lloyd Pye, and number three, Mr. Michael Tellinger.
Oh, sure. Well, I'll comment on those people. I'll start off with Michael Tellinger. I know that he is one of the few people, like Mr. Hellier, who's actually held Dr. Wood's book up in public and said, read this book. You know, he did that in a presentation, I think it was maybe about a year ago. I actually met Michael Tellinger at the conference in 2012, and I had a quick chat with him, and I think he's a great guy, and I think he's been doing some very important work with the Ubuntu movement. I'm not quite sure about the political side of it, but I think the principle of what he's doing and what he's managed to do, I think, is pretty amazing. Really, he's obviously got a lot of energy and a lot of perseverance. I'm not sure I could do what he's done. So I admire him greatly for that. Lloyd Pye, I was a very good friend of mine, and I was deeply saddened by his death in December 2013. I'd known him for almost 10 years, and I found that what he's put forward about human origins and evolution and so forth is very, very interesting stuff. And particularly his research into the Star Child skull, I've become very, very familiar with that, and I've spoken about that myself in public. I think that's a hugely important artifact, which, like Dr. Wood's book, for example, very few of the UFO researchers will talk about the Star Child skull. Stephen Greer won't talk about it. Stanton Friedman won't talk about it. You know, and it's a massive piece of physical evidence, which I would, if I was pushed, I would say it is an alien skull. It's the skull of an alien being. That's what I think it is. I don't think it's difficult to prove it beyond doubt because we don't have any examples to compare it to in the public domain, at least. But
they can prove it's non-human.
Yeah, non-human. But yet, superficially, it looks human. And I've talked for so long, I can't remember who the third researcher was. I know I'll remember it immediately. You say?
I'd actually asked you on Facebook about him before.
Passio.
His name is Mark Passio.
Oh, Mark Passio, yes, sorry, yeah. Mark Passio, I've not communicated with Mark.
You won't talk about my work.
He doesn't seem to, yeah. We'll come back. Well, he hasn't really mentioned Dr. Wood's book, but he's said a lot of interesting stuff about 9/11.
Yeah.
But maybe I'll just say a little bit more after the break. I don't know how long this music's going to go on, but we'll stay on the line, and we'll talk a little more after the break. Good morning, good evening, good afternoon, wherever you are in the world. My name is Andrew Johnson. We're in the last portion of the program now, although we will have one or two more breaks in this last 27 minutes or so. And we've been talking with Dr. Judy Wood about 9/11. My website is checktheevidence.com. Dr. Wood's is drjudywood.com. We have Philip on the line from, I think, North Carolina. We were talking about a researcher called Mark Passio, and I just wanted to, I'll get Phil back on in a minute, but one of the things I'd remembered during the break was I think Mark Passio has done some excellent research into some of the occult aspects of 9/11. He's done some very interesting videos. There's one very interesting video on that, which I thought was I thought was pretty, you know, I think he was, a lot of it was right from what I could see. But curiously, as I think Dr. Wood has started to say, he won't talk about Dr. Wood's book. He won't really talk about that research, which I think is rather curious. However, there may be a partial explanation for that, not that it excuses him, in my mind at least. He did, a few years ago, organise a conference called the Free Your Mind Conference, and two of the conference attendees at that conference, I'm sure this will be archived in archive.org if you want to see it, were Jim Fetzer and Bob Tuskin, both of whom have essentially been involved in attacks on Dr. Wood, or maybe definitely in the case of Fetzer, attack is not too strong of a word, but Bob Tuskin appears to have helped set up a kind of ambush call, which you can also listen to on the web if you want it. That raises a couple of question marks about Mark Passio in my mind, but I don't know, maybe he didn't know who Fetzer was, or maybe somebody else organised that conference and just said that Fetzer would be a good guy to invite, etc., etc. So I don't know if you've got any feedback on that, Philip.
I have heard that conversation, yes, sir, and kind of for me, the litmus test for any researcher that I want to listen to and resonate with is whether or not they will recognize and even talk about Dr. Wood and, of course, her book, Where Did the Powers Go? But I appreciate you allowing me to ask that question, and it's been a pleasure to talk to you guys.
Well, thank you very much for the question, and yes, I feel the same way. I it is a litmus test. We've said in other broadcasts that, Dr. Wood's book, you put it in front of somebody and the reaction can be sometimes like flicking holy water on a vampire, you know, and that was an expression that was used by a friend of mine a few years back, and I think it's still appropriate. Okay.
I would like to insert that I actually did call into this program about a year ago, and there is a YouTube clip up on the internet of our conversation in which I called in and asked him if he had an opportunity to read the book. This is Mr. Passy, of course. He got into kind of conspiracy and what that means for about 10 to 15 minutes. We came back from a break. He asked me if I wanted to ask another question, and I just repeated the first question. I asked him if he had the opportunity to read the book. He said that he had not, that he had seen some videos. And then from that point, my goal was to kind of just go through some points of evidence that I've been able to absorb. And I guess kind of regurgitate them on that program in the time that I was allowed.
Good for you.
Good, yeah, well, that's absolutely great, Philip, and I think, you know, that process of just trying to get people to comment can often be very revealing. I mean, somebody like Mark Passio is clearly an accomplished researcher. I think, you know, something similar to what I said earlier in the program. He's clearly a very intelligent man, with a great ability to research things. I've seen some of his Mark Passio's presentations. He knows how to put, attention-grabbing PowerPoint presentations together and things like this. He knows how to do video editing. He runs a regular podcast. He does all of that stuff. He talks about 9/11, so you'd think it would be high on his list of priorities to get a good handle on the sort of research that's in Dr. Wood's book, yet, you know, it's been out, for 4.5, almost 5 years now. Why is he not, said, oh my God, you know, this is like amazing, and kind of thanked you for bringing that up as an issue, you know, when you called in. I think I have heard some of that clip. I think it's the same one. So again, I thank you very much for doing that.
Oh, no, it was a pleasure, and I called in because, and my reasoning for asking him that question at the time was, in order, the name of his website is, of course, What on Earth is Happening, and I feel that for someone to ask themselves the question, What on Earth is Happening, I think that person has to have a reason, And I can't think of a more important reason that has affected humanity and human consciousness in the aggregate, and a more important event than September the 11th.
And I totally agree with you.
Yes, ma'am.
And I'd like, I think there was another quote I was going to read out, Philip, from another friend of mine. This was, came from a chap called Peter, who has met with Dr. Wood and myself on a couple of occasions when Dr. Wood was in the UK. Peter came to see us both in 2011 and 2012. And he'll know who he is if he's listening. But and I lost the exact quote. See, I had it in an email or something, or it might have been a YouTube message. And I got the essence of the quote. And what he said was he felt, and I think I agree with him, that the forces or energies that were employed in the destruction of the World Trade Center on 9/11 are those from which life itself arises. And I think he's right about that. In other words, somebody knows how to engineer the underlying fabric of the reality that, you know, our 3D reality that we're enslaved in. And then to use another phrase that I was given today, or yesterday, we're enslaved in, and we're now in a cage. But what's been happening is people have been making it out that it's a golden cage now. We've got all these wonderful bits of technology and this sort of thing. So we now live in a golden cage rather than just a cage with drab iron bars. We've got gold bars and lots of decoration around the bars, so we might not actually notice them.
What I've often said is he who controls the energy controls the people, but he who controls their perception controls everything.
Yes, yes. So this idea of perception management is vital for them to keep going. And I think many of the alternative knowledge researchers actually, some of them without realizing that, are actually part of this perception management operation. And I would specifically highlight people like Stephen Greer, who, you know, I'm very familiar with. And again, Stephen Greer, I think I mentioned him earlier in the program, I mention him again now, very smart man, much smarter than me, you know, emergency room doctor, very articulate, eloquent speaker, very far better command of the English language than I have. Yet he talks about 9/11 being done by Al-Qaeda, you know. I mean, seriously, you know. So there's something not right with this picture, as Dr. Wood might say, and I sometimes say as well.
Can I ask another question?
Certainly. I don't think there's any other callers, so if you have more questions, please go right ahead.
I'm under the impression that there are still today over 1,100 of the victims from 9/11 that they haven't found anything of. Am I correct in that thinking?
Yeah, something like that. There's quite a few of them.
It would appear that the
number of people that have been identified through some part of DNA or something are approximately equal to the number of people who went out the windows, and the 343 firefighters down at the bottom, and a few others. But the people still in the building, right? There's no traces of.
Yes, ma'am, and that's actually one of the talking points that I kind of have when I talk to someone. And you guys even mentioned a statement, I believe Dr. Wood did earlier, that she hears a lot, that they found all of the steel and they shipped it all to China. Well, I have a question.
In the first 10 minutes.
Yes, ma'am. My question, if they found all of the components of the building and they found all of the steel, then why is it they found absolutely no trace of over 1,100 human beings?
Yes. That's an excellent statement.
Yes, I mean, you know, if it was true, this story about the steel being shipped to China, then what about, you know, extracting the bodies from the debris before it was shipped? That's never talked about in this explanation that was fed into the truth movement early on, is it? And it's something which people don't stop to think about. It's again a way of managing people's perception by, you know, giving them some truth in the form of, well, yeah, there's no debris. Oh, yeah, well, that's true, but we'll tell them that it was all quickly shipped to China, and that will shut down those questions. We give them an answer to that question so they don't need to ask it again at a later point.
Yes, sir, and another kind of talking point I've developed is I understand that architects and engineers are experts at drawing a plan and constructing buildings. From what I understand, they are not experts at building turning into dust. But whenever I have someone come up and they start, you know, kind of rattling off the type of propaganda that group will espouse, I'll kind of put that out there. It's kind of the same listening to, I don't know, crocheters and yarning for 9/11 truth.
Yes, that's absolutely right, Philip, and even, you know, further
architects,
than that.
Architects, you know, decide where the bathrooms go and the floor layout plan and things like that. They don't have any kind of engineering expertise. They can't sign off on engineering drawings. They are not forensic engineers or scientists.
Right, and I mean, even in the case of Richard Gage, he has admitted publicly, we have recordings of him, saying that he doesn't understand the seismic evidence, that's why he doesn't talk about it. So how can he possibly come to any sort of valid conclusion about the destructive mechanism that was used to destroy the towers? He can't, and he actually publicly admits this. You know, and those that follow this architects and engineers group, which there are legion apparently, they don't seem to be aware of this, and they also don't seem to be aware of past architects and engineers membership vetting guidelines, which were published in a book a few years ago called Nano Management, the Destruction of a Truth Group. I forget the exact title, but I've got it on a blog that I put together called 911thermitefree.blogspot.com. And in that document, there is, which is the vetting guidelines for the Architects and Engineers for 9/11 group, there's only one person named in the whole of human history which should be included in keyword searches when you're checking out these members or potential members for this group, the Architects and Engineers group. And that the only named person is not Adolf Hitler, it's not, you know, it's not Genghis Khan, it's not, you know, Chairman Mao, it's Judy Wood. So why would this...
You know, something I'd like to mention here before we lose the opportunity is thank you for bringing this up, that I discuss the destructive mechanism. I don't discuss a weapon. Remember, mm-hmm. First you have to determine what happened before you determine how it happened. And I'm only determining what happened. And that's why I describe a destructive mechanism as being... you know, energy was instructed somehow, directed, to do something differently than it normally does. But somehow some folks want to compare that with this 18th century technology of thermite. You know, it's apples and oranges.
Yes.
Yes, ma'am.
So what did thermite, you know, what was the destructive mechanism that thermite caused? They never covered that. Someone needs to ask them that. Did it melt the buildings? Did it? You know, was it kinetic energy? Was it thermal energy? What are they claiming? Destroyed the buildings.
I think we can make a little prediction here, because what we've seen in the past is when Richard Gage goes and does these 30-day tours in Canada and Europe. I think I noticed this a few years back now that, you know, I don't know if it was you or me or somebody else that was.
Yeah. He responds to things we've said.
Yeah, and I think one of the things we started to talk about was a forensic investigation. And then I think it was a few months after that that was the language he started using in one or two of his presentations.
Then why does he call for a new investigation?
Yeah. So let us see if he starts using this destructive mechanism terminology, which is, you know, we started to use that a few times in the last, I think, six months or a year. It'll be interesting to see if he now tries to slot that into his presentations, you know, to try and sort of do a whack-a-mole with the terminology. You know, maybe we should come out with some other appropriate phrases.
Makes me feel important that Richard Gage tailors everything he does around me. It makes me feel important.
Yeah, well, I mean, I say to people that if you look at the commentary on the internet for some of your videos, and for example, the Miles Power review that we've discussed in articles, and the video by James Easton. And I'll just mention this for listeners if they want to go and check this out. It's pretty shocking to watch, really, but there's a character called James Easton, and surprisingly, he even uses his real name on this YouTube video. And the YouTube video is called Correcting the Damage Done to 9/11 Research or something. And it consists of him tearing up, on camera, a copy of Where Did the Towers Go? And I don't think I've ever seen such an extreme reaction to any other topic.
I wonder whose book he tore up. Who loaned it to him?
Well, indeed, it says it was his friend's book, doesn't he? So I don't know what the friend thought of him doing this on YouTube video. Apparently, we have another caller, Richard in Alabama. So I think if we've got a few minutes left now, I think we'll have a bit of time to talk to Richard. I'd like to thank Philip for his contribution. So let's see if we can bring Richard on. Oh, we've got a break now, so let's bring Richard on maybe after the break. And we're going to be talking about 9/11 and the cover-up. My name's Andrew Johnson, and we shall speak to you in a few minutes, and we'll see what Richard has to say. Thanks for listening. Hello, we're back after the break. Good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in the world. Good morning, even. And I believe we have a caller on the line, Richard from Alabama. So I don't know if we can get Richard on, and we haven't got much time, unfortunately, but we'll try and fit something in.
Oh, no. On the subject of insurance fraud, there was never an investigation by the insurance companies of any possible insurance fraud, because Congress gave them $7 billion to pay them off 110% for their liability. So Rockefeller got some money and no investigation.
Well, and, I don't think that's anything we've talked about today.
Well, yeah, we
I know it.
I think I take your point in that I think there is a whole other network of corruption. I think a lot of other researchers several of the researchers have addressed that. I think that I don't know what to think about all of that, because I think it's a lot harder to establish the truth of some of the political machinations.
The timing was amazing, and the rules of court that denied discovery to the 9/11 victim families. They couldn't get discovery of any evidence. They couldn't question anybody or subpoena anybody. And those new rules came out at 9 a.m. on the morning of 9/11/2001.
Well, it's not something I've researched, but it would not surprise me, Richard. And also, you know, just to give you another example of that sort of thing, we had the Prevention of Terrorism Act here in the UK, and that was actually passed through Parliament in the year 2000. You know, so it does make you wonder how much of this was planned, put into legislation and so forth. Again, it's not something we've really discussed tonight, but I think it's, valid questions are raised in the areas that you've mentioned. And, are the Rockefellers involved? Are the Rothschilds involved? But maybe they are. I mean, they appear to have a lot
more
of money.
More than maybe.
Well, that's for you to say, because it's not something I've researched enough to be that confident, but you're obviously welcome to sort of say that if you think that's the truth.
Well, there's no possibility of investigation because they control the rules of court.
Mm. Yes. Well, I mean, this is something that Dr. Wood experienced with her court case, when they had dismissed the appeal case. They admitted that they ignored the change in the law. So yes, you know,
they ignored the law to dismiss the case.
Yeah. So I think that's similar to what you just said, with regard to some of the insurance fraud as well. So we've only got 1 minute left, Richard, so I don't know whether if you wanted to mention anything else before I sort of wrap it up and just say thanks to everyone for listening and everything.
Ask somebody who's an expert on concrete what makes concrete dustify.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, concrete's a different thing because concrete can be dustified by mechanical impact, whereas the steel girders, they need something else to turn them to dust.
So, not even this fine. There's no hammer hitting concrete can turn into nano-sized particles.
Yes, yes. So exactly.
Well, something did. Ask an expert on concrete.
Well, we know about that. That's in Dr. Wood's book. So, you know, if you want to read it or watch the presentations, you can learn more about what that process probably, you know, was.